And the reason that I met John was because, I think it was back in April, I went to a neuromedicine conference in Denver, and up comes this neurosurgeon who is the head of that whole operation, the director of the neurosurgery center, and who's one of the nationally, he is a, the nationally known expert for a Chiari-1 malformation of the brain, and who's also written a book about the Chiari malformation, who was talking about, in his presentation, about how he felt that dementia, the many different kinds of dementia, were really based in inflammatory changes in the body and in the brain, and then launches into talking about the paleo diet, and my mouth just dropped open.
Thank you to Rohini for inviting me. This is a real honor. It's a real pleasure. It's just wonderful. And it's great to be with all the panelists. And I think it's an exciting time in this area of healthcare. And it's nice to have the conflict and the argument, because that's where we're going to try to learn and move forward. And I'm going to talk to you about the Paleolithic diet, and we're going to get moving. And this is the puzzle. This is the puzzle. It's an idealized graph. It's an idealized graph. But something happened here 2.7 to 3 million years ago. This hockey stick. If something didn't happen, our brains would be about here, and you wouldn't have the smartphone in your pocket. Or your purse. What happened? The only thing we can find is a stone that's etched, that's broken, that's purposefully shaped. This is the first time in the known universe that we're aware of this. And we began to eat meat more so. And then what we see is another acceleration, almost a doubling of the rate of expansion of the human brain. What do we find around here? Fire. Recently in South Africa, we have the embers that are dated to a million years. There are scientists on this campus that are showing that maybe even sooner than that. What's important about fire? Food was broken down, made it much easier to chew and digest. There was more surface area available to absorb the nutrients. More calories were available per serving. Less gut time. Much more efficient. We in the Paleolithic, at least in the Paleolithic, we picked prime real estate. Our image of our Paleolithic ancestors is a little bit off. They found the best places to live that they could find. They lived in southern France. When I was in this cave 20 years ago with my father and my young son to look at the cave, what fascinated me was where our ancestors bathed and swam and drank clean water and had clean air. And yes, they did have to hunt for their food or their protein. Moving on a little bit, 80 to 90,000 years ago, we find bone harpoons like this, and a prehistoric catfish might weigh 150 pounds. It could feed 80 people for 2 days. What do you call that? You call it a party. You call it a social experience and event. And indeed, they had more leisure time than we do. Modern hunter-gatherers have more leisure time per day than you do, and that I do, and we all do. And then there's something that's happening in South Africa, and we're living along the coast, and we have yet to find a lot of our ancestors along the coast because the sea level is higher. But something important was going on. By the way, the sea level back then was way out here. So they could go out and pick all kinds of seafood, and something happened to the human brain. Abstract thinking, or doodling. Look at these lines. These are parallel lines, crosshatches. Is that lightning? Is that an animal? That's us. That is us 70, 80,000 years ago. The human brain was expanding. We lived in small bands, and we tended to be egalitarian. We then crossed Beringia and went down the west coast. Some of us, we spread throughout the world, as we know. And we ate shellfish and salmon and waterfowl and caribou and other land animals. We made it to California, the Channel Islands. And what did we do? We dropped our clothes and we started fishing. But fish is important, and it seems to parallel the development of Homo sapiens 200,000 years ago. So there are some clues that this is the diet that made us human. And then we had the agricultural revolution and the first grinding stones about 15,000 years ago. With fewer acres, we could feed a greater population. And it likely started with the collection of wild grains. And a couple of thousand years later, we domesticated animals. What did we get? We got a new upper class. There was a division now. We went from villages to chiefdoms to paramount chiefdoms and finally to states and empires. We became shorter, at least around the Mediterranean. In Greece, this article, men lost 5 inches in height, women lost 3 inches in height. We developed bone mineral deficiencies, osteoporosis, rickets, and a bunch of other vitamin deficiencies. We lived closer to animals. We took on tuberculosis, smallpox, measles, the plague, and flu from the animals crossing to humans. And this research is continuing. This is 2011 from Emory, and the title says it all. Early farmers were sicker and shorter than their forager ancestors. Now, the argument has been, but they didn't live that long. Correct. On average, that's correct. But you know what? It hardly ever changed until the late 1800s. As a matter of fact, for men, once the Neolithic started, they actually shortened a little bit. But the bottom line is, until we controlled infant mortality and infectious disease, we really didn't get this jump. And then I'm going to jump you all the way over forward to the early 1900s to Freud's nephew. He was an expert in public relations. He's viewed as the father. And he's viewed as the father of peacetime propaganda. He saw what wartime propaganda could do to mobilize people, World War I. He introduced that concept because he thought the masses were irrational, that we had to be led and moved. And his ideas permeated the advertising industry. And the biggest company was then Procter & Gamble. And they created an artificial substance, a chemically modified substance, Crisco, hydrogenated oils. How are we going to get people to eat artificial stuff? We're going to use Freud's nephew's psychological ideas. And look at this. This is a mother with a child. They're both leaning toward this product. There's an open window, there's a breeze, there's plants. It's just a conception. It's a psychological, emotional connection that this is going to be okay for us. And it had 50% trans fat. And how many of our relatives were affected by that throughout the century? And this continues. We make and create food, okay? We create it. And we're stripping the earth, okay? We are intensifying on our assault on the animal kingdom. This is the main destroyer of ecosystems throughout the world and of the animal kingdom. And as one fellow put it, the planet is getting skinned. And it continues. This is the Amazon in 2000. We're like ants on the planet. This is 2010. Now, E.O. Wilson, famous biologist, basically the habitats. We used to live in habitats in more balance. Instead, became land to be cleared for agriculture. And we developed Western diseases. And the CDC tells us that in our country, 3/4 of healthcare spending is spent on preventable chronic diseases. They're also called modern diseases, etc. And what are these? I won't read this list, but we all recognize them. These are the diseases we deal with today. Let me give you one example. This is diabetes type 2. I'm going to repeat that for you. This is 2004. It's like a virus spreading through our country. This is 2006, and this is 2008. And for those of us who think, you know, we've been a little protected here in Colorado, we're getting hit, okay? And so at the end of the last decade, Science Journal, one of the two top journals of science in the world, looked at the insights of the decade. And one of the insights is inflammation. Over the past decade, it has become widely accepted that inflammation is a driving force behind chronic diseases that will kill nearly all of us. Cancer, diabetes, obesity, Alzheimer's, atherosclerosis. Here, inflammation wears a grim mask. And where does most inflammation come from? Or at least the one we're talking about today. It comes from our gut. This is the one area of our body that we allow foreign substances to come in. We actually choose to put them in there, right? And this is why the bulk of the immune system is in the gut. It's there to help you and allow the right things to come in. And thankfully, we have tight junctions. And these are very valuable. This is an electron microscope. That means that the gut will accept material that's processed through the cell membrane to get into the bloodstream. Okay? If it breaks the barrier, it can invade the bloodstream directly. Okay? And what opens these tight junctions? Well, gliadin can, the gluten of protein, lectins in beans and grains, the glycoalkaloids in potatoes and in cereals, and cereals and beans have inhibitors to be able to break down that protein. So it's a double hit. We know the celiac disease. I don't have to go through this. I view it as a chronic gluten poisoning. Somebody with celiac disease didn't start out with a disease. They are fine. It's their living in a modern diet. If they were in a paleolithic diet, there'd be no such thing as a celiac disease. And what happens, these are the villi. They're probably pretty hard to see. These are white cells. They're just chronically inflamed trying to protect the body from this invasion. 42,000 children are lost. The problem is we're now learning that in some of us, gluten can get into the brain. And lo and behold, the blood-brain barrier has the same kind of tight junctions. Now, we don't know yet if it's breaking through the junctions or if it's getting through the cell itself, but we do well know that in some of us, it's getting into the brain. And we have a condition called gluten ataxia, where the Purkinje cell that runs the main cell of your cerebellum, it cross-reacts and the antibodies start hurting your cerebellum, and you're going to get ataxia, poor coordination, can get headaches and speech difficulty. But it goes from there. It can inflame your spinal cord. You have someone in the family that might have a neuropathy. Have they asked and have they looked? Is it the gluten? Is it a continuous insult that they don't know they're giving themselves? What about schizophrenia? We don't know yet, but it's peculiar that if you look at persons with schizophrenia, they have a higher than expected titers of antibodies to celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. Now, is there any hard evidence? This is one study. I think it's a very important study. You look at 321 patients. Their average age 63. This is one marker of inflammation. So they're looking at C-reactive protein in their blood. And they're taking the top third, those with the highest C-reactive protein, comparing it to the lowest third, the least inflammation, if you will. And they're sticking all of them in an MRI, those two groups. Those with the highest, their brains are on average 12 years older. Going on, what's the worst mental disease you can have is to lose your mind. The Alzheimer's Association tells us 1 out of 8 of us is going to lose our mind in this way. And here we have nutrition and Alzheimer's disease, the detrimental role of a high carbohydrate diet. In this paper, we highlight how an excessive dietary carbohydrate, particularly fructose, alongside a relative deficiency of dietary fat and cholesterol, may lead to the development of Alzheimer's disease. What about hunter-gatherers? We don't know. A big systematic study hasn't been done, although this is pretty close. We do have a psychiatrist that in his notebooks, he spent a lot of time in East Africa in the 30s, senile dementia was a notable absentee. And in Catawbans, in 2500, no signs of dementia. Dementia is probably a modern disease. Can we go back to the garden? The answer is no. We cannot. We can't reach, as has already been mentioned, those type of plants and those type of proteins, if you will. But we can approximate it. One of the experts is at Fort Collins, Dr. Lauren Cordain, and what he says is that our ancestors ate no dairy. It's immunogenic. It's highly insulinotropic. It has an insulin index similar to white bread. And they hardly ever ate cereal grains. They might have been used in conditions of starvation, but we can't ferment grains. We can't, on our own, unless they're processed, we can't get much energy out of grains. Vegetables, long list of nutrients. These were uncultivated vegetables, and their fiber content, tremendously higher than today. So when you see that cereal box and it says high fiber, you ought to chuckle. It's minuscule toward what at least our Paleolithic ancestors had as far as fiber intake. Fruit almost as dense in nutrients as vegetables. You have to Now, Cordain says you have to consume a huge amount to get much fructose. Others, because of the modern nature of our fruits, are a little more cautious on that. Now, what about meats and protein? That's the big issue. It might be a difference between a plant-based approach and this approach. We've lost our respect for our food supply. You cannot photograph a factory farm. It's against the law. I didn't know that until recently. They don't want us to see what happens in that setting. And if we think back to our ancestors, and at least if we look at some modern tribes, these are the people of the Anaconda in the Amazon, and basically they believe it's a transfer of energy from one life to another. Meat is not the right of the hunter, but a gift from the spirit world. And frankly, they lived in this world. Man in the forest is always both a predator and prey. So let's talk about meats. They have the highest thermic effect. They are the highest in satisfying, satiating value. They increase HDL cholesterol. They're the best source of iron, B12, zinc. They're important for amino acids for enzymes that are crucial to brain function and transport of structural molecules. Fish and shellfish, we know, of course, the omega-3s, which are crucial to the myelin function of the nerve transmission. Bottom line is ancestral nutrition is non-inflammatory. Does it work? Well, there's anecdote, and we certainly are not going to hear the large studies that we've heard about up to now. So I'll just give you a little bit of what we have. This is a new look at the world's oldest diet, if you will, or at least the oldest human diet. Does it work? There's always anecdote with any diet, and I just view it as that. That you should view this as anecdote, but the answer is, at least anecdotally, it works. Let's take a look at this lady. And what's interesting to me is, not only, of course, is she slimmed down tremendously, but if you look at her face, her brain is working differently than it is here. And it works for the reverse. Anorexia can also be brought under great control by this approach. There's been a reversal of carbs, at least according, and there are others that are viewing this. Dr. Willett, chairman of the Department of Nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health, fat is not the problem. If Americans could eliminate sugary beverages, potatoes, white bread, pasta, white rice, and sugary snacks, we would wipe out almost all the problems we have with weight and diabetes and other metabolic diseases. Here is a recent theoretical paper, actually last month. It is time to consider the possibility that implicating dietary fat as the primary cause and advocating that it be minimized has been a fundamental error, looking at in the Journal of Diabetes, Metabolic Syndrome, and Obesity. Now, there are bloggers, just like with any other diet, okay? And Dr. William Davis, a cardiologist in Wisconsin, has the HeartScan blog, and he's got a whip-smart attorney in his office, and his cholesterol numbers, the bad cholesterol, are way out of line. And this is the worst cholesterol. The small cholesterol is the one that gets under your arteries. Okay? And he advises him to eliminate wheat, corn, starch, and sugars. Well, Joe, the attorney, didn't like that idea so much, but he went to whole grains. He did agree to go to whole grains. And he dropped his really bad cholesterol down a bit. Given the severity of his pattern, I suggested trying again, this time with full elimination of grains, and this is when he drops it down. Now, this is a case, and that's all it is, okay? And I agree to that. That's just a case. Now, the studies in this field are small, but they're not correlational studies. They're not big survey studies, which are valuable, but you can never get cause and effect from just simply looking at correlations, okay? So even though these are small, they're certainly, they should catch our attention. Now look at this diet. 9 non-obese, sedentary, healthy volunteers, okay? They're sedentary, but they're not obese. The paleo diet was matched exactly by calorie. The input was the same as far as calorie. And they basically had significantly lower blood pressure, glucose tolerance, large significant reductions in total cholesterol, low density lipoprotein, the LDL, and triglycerides. Now, we in the paleo group are going to challenge this idea that it's all about calories in, calories out. It's really about the quality of your food, okay? So we improved. This engine was running better because it got better fuel. Here's another study. Now, this is a crossover study. So we're going to take patients with type 2 diabetes. Small amount, I agree. They're going to, half of them or part of them are going to do the diabetes diet for 3 months and then do the paleo diet for 3 months. And then they're going to, the other group's going to do the opposite. So it's as controlled as we can possibly make it, if you will. Okay? And sure enough, this handily beats the diabetic diet in patients with diabetes. You take 29 men with ischemic heart disease and impaired glucose tolerance in diabetes type 2. You compare them to the Paleolithic, to the Mediterranean diet. Now, I'm Mediterranean. I love the Mediterranean diet. I think it was a good transitional point for me. I ate it most of my life, and I'm thankful that I did. On the other hand, we heard how important it is to feel satisfied. And we've learned, that, at least in this very small trial, that it's more satisfying to have the Paleolithic diet. So, in conclusion, the Paleolithic diet is a modern approximation of what we think we understand about our Paleolithic ancestors. Okay? It is based on our genetic heritage. It depends on how far back you want to go in the hominid line, if you will, or if you want to go to tool making, then it's a three million year old diet. Then, if we start with, 2.7 to 3 million years ago, it's non-inflammatory, and we believe the evidence is slowly growing, although small. Thank you very much.